But not a week. She says, a day. You get me?
Yeah.
And what a shock. What a shock. And I'm spending my money on it.
And before you thought you were doing really well.
Yeah. Yeah. $22 a day. I never heard of such a thing. So I said, well, damn it, I'm going to Ohio. And I thought I had a pretty good contact in her there in Ohio. And I was talking to her in June. In September, I'm driving my car. I'm with some other guys, and I go to Ohio. We stop by Cincinnati on the way to Columbus. The very woman that we'd been out with, she was glad to see us and invited us in. And I had these two friends with me. They were going to go to Wilberforce. And you know, she hasn't invited us to have a bite to eat, a coffee, and we're coming all across the country. We'd stopped before, but my point is, she didn't prove to be much of a hostess. And you find out about people. It used me, you see, and that's it. But she guided me to a good thing, because I might not ever finish school, but she hadn't said that.
Here at USC?
Anywhere. Don't forget, I'm working out there at Finley's now. I've kind of dropped out of school for a while.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, 6 to 6.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when she told me they're making that kind of money back east.
Did you find that there were many opportunities in Ohio, more than here?
Listen, first of all, I got engrossed in school. And secondly, when I married Lillian Bellinger, it just looked like it opened up new vistas to me, because they had done so much. And you could see that if you don't limit yourself, you might emulate them and do well too. And then she was ambitious. She was telling me what I could do in San Antonio. And she had just introduced me to the type of life that I just never seen. For instance, she could get on a phone call the manager of her bank down there in San Antonio, and whatever she said, send. And you learned that there was success mm-hmm. out there if you just go after it, you know.
So that it really inspired you and propelled you forward.
Yeah. See, it was kind of a closed world then, but I didn't realize it. My ambition was, I thought it was high, but it was nowhere near what could be. Yeah, that was a real turning point in my life, so meeting her. And I give them, that family, credit for a lot that happened to me. Yeah.
So then you finished law school at Ohio State?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And then you came back to L.A. Well, went to Texas and then came back to L.A.?
Yes.
And what year was that?
36.
And so you were gone for, 4 years?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And what did you do? What were the first things you did when you came back?
Started practicing law. No. First I had to wait to take the bar. So I came back in 36, and I started studying for the bar, and took the bar in 37. And doing 36, 37 is when I gave all those dances. See, that's the way... you had to sustain yourself during that period of time. And I sold real estate.
And was that a really good, the entertainment scene?
Yes.
That was a really popular...
Yes.
Was that about the time when the clubs really started to emerge on Central Avenue? And it became that very exciting music scene?
Yes. Round from 30 on through, the clubs on Central, particularly the Club Alabama, became the mecca for whites from all over, and the run by a man by the name of Curtis Mosby, who used to have an orchestra. His orchestra used to be Curtis Mosby's Blues Blower. And he was made the manager of the Alabama, but the Alabama was owned by some Rizzo brothers, the Italian members who lived over there, and by the way, they were a very clandestine group of about six or seven brothers. They dressed alike, they wore somber clothing, they drove big expensive automobiles and fedora hats, and had very little to do with the people around them. And they surrounded them. Those are the people who ran the Alabama. I've heard a lot of things about the Alabama, but my father was had to rent some of those places around the Alabama, and he had direct contact with them. And so that's the situation. That might, you hear all about the Alabama and so forth, but I would almost say it was gangster control, and I think they were gangsters.
What about some of the other clubs down there? What were the big ones?
The others were all black clubs, and they didn't attract. They were interesting, but they didn't attract the crowd to Alabama. There's valet service to Alabama. You park your car, people take them, and you go and park your car, you get liquor there. And knowing what I know now, I can understand what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a huge thing. And I just got the reading about these. I have a book by a man by the name of Travis about Chicago and its clubs. An Italian men opened up clubs they were thought to be black clubs, but it was run by other persons. So it might have been just a type of a program all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
I just got the reading about that subject, and it interprets for me what's happening here.
Like, for instance, with the Club Alabama.
Club Alabama. Uh-huh.
What do you remember, too, about the kind of music that was becoming popular and your impressions of that? And
well, one of my class and close friends was Ivy Anderson. And Ivy Anderson was the headliner at the Club Alabama. Ivy. And she later went with Duke Ellington. And she was the songstress of Duke. And her famous one song was Rocks in My Bed. I don't know if you ever heard of that. But anyway, Ivy was a headliner at the Alabama. And I remember her and the rest, like Joe Turner and so forth, were Johnny Come Latelys. They would sing it at some of the smaller clubs and so forth. But for the period that the Alabama lasted, she was the headliner. And they would bring in, I suspect, people that I was not at that time old enough to be one of those persons that in and out of those places I would ride by. But Ivy, I did get to know very well.
So you weren't going out a lot to the clubs at the time?
No, because let's see how old I was then. say 1928, at 20, I would be 20, and I might have had a liking to going out, but I was in school and very country. And
you lived way up here, too.
Yeah, I lived out here in Bairdstown. I'd come in town to sell papers and see people, but I'd see things, but I wouldn't understand them as well as mm-hmm, I do today. Mm-hmm.
But then when you came back in 1936,
yes,
and you were doing the club, doing the Battle of the Bands,
yes,
then you were really immersed.
Yes. Yeah. I was it then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I knew what was happening then pretty well. So
how had the music changed, and what was really popular? What was the rage?
Don't forget, you had spells of music during the Alabama's trip. It was blues and so forth, and then I knew fellows like Witherspoon and Joe Turner and Jimmy Russian of Count Basie, and of course Billie Holiday, and all of those folks, I got to know them very well. I would go and I'd go and visit with Louise Beavers, and she had a house down on Harvard Boulevard, and all that crowd, I got to run with them and grew at the same time, and it was a very sophisticated crowd, and if I didn't know, I learned fast, and it was more or less it. Mm-hmm. I rode the tide, and I formed very fine friendships with most of those people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put us on pause here for a minute. Mm-hmm. Just a minute.
About when I went through the Panama Canal on my one of my trips, I bought, while I was down there, I was impressed by the great market and the possibility of, there's so many possibilities of making money. I bought some scarves at Cologne. And when we got off the ship, just during that limited period, I had made some money on the ship to one of my amazing streaks of luck. I made almost $2,000 on the ship, and I was a rank amateur gambling. I never played dice, didn't know how to play dice, and won nearly all the money. It caused me to be called before the captain, want to know what my background had been and so forth. And I couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe it when I told him, look, I have never gambled before in my life. So I bought scarves. I don't know what got into me to get these. And they were beautiful in various colors, like purple and red and brown, silk. And I got off this boat in Philadelphia with all these scarves. And I want you to know that when I got to, it was Broad Avenue, Broad Street, a crowd gathered around me, and whatever price I must have given, it must have been cheap, because those scarves were gone in a half hour. And you know what I mean? I was thinking about how it awoke me to the fact that what opportunities out here, you know, just,
and you are very enterprising.
Yeah. Some people in one part of the world want what other people have, you know. Yeah.
Okay, well, this is going to be the end right now of part one.
All right.
Okay? And because we're at the end of the tape. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, this is Amy Kitchener with Mr. Walter Gordon at his home for part two of our interview on October 6th, 1993. One thing I wanted to ask you about was where you were during the Great Depression, and did that affect you and your family?
Yes, very much. I was in Los Angeles, and in my previous session, I told you about how I met this teacher from Cincinnati, and that she was indicating to me that she was making $22 a day. Well, that just stimulated me a great deal to at least made me realize that maybe I could do better somewhere else, and at least I could perfect my education because things were so poor in Los Angeles. And I work in 12 hours a day from 6 to 6 and cleaning slats and working behind a soda fountain at Finley's was making only $16 or so a week. And Mr. Finley informed me he had to reduce my wages at least $2 a week. I knew that he was evidently expressing the truth because he liked me very much and I liked him. And so I went on back to school. In the meanwhile, I would hear from my father. I was in Columbus when word spread of the bank closings. My father, I knew, was in business. I knew he was collecting rents of other people, and that such news, when he finally got it, would be a disaster to him. So I immediately got on the phone and called him, and apparently the news was being withheld from California. My father knew nothing about the banks closing back there, and or the threat to close them, and I was able to get the news to him in time, wherein he withdrew money, and he called me up to tell me it really had saved him so much, because where these land owners were clamoring for their money, he was able to give it to them, which enabled him to get more business because they were very appreciative of that. So that was it. And at that time, I was living in a big two-story house owned by some people on 11th Avenue in Columbus, and I went to school there and lived in this house, and I worked at lunchtime for my meals, and there were bread lines everywhere, and things were real rough, and it lasted that way for some time.
Were you very lucky to be in college at the time?
Yes, I think so. Being in college at that time, there's more or less just enabled me to just kind of, rather than lose by virtue of the depression, I took that time off to really make myself better equipped to handle the future. And it came. The effects of it, well, we had the various job corps, and when I finally got out of school in 36, I heard about OPA, and I saw the men going to work on trucks and so forth, and they were spending their money, and I would hear Roosevelt and these fireside chats, and these things began to change the aura of depression that was around us. And I came out of the situation from a personal standpoint very fine condition, because I was able to give dances such as I previously mentioned, and I was able to earn a very good living. So that was it.
So in 1937, you got your law degree. Was there a reason why? Did you open? When did you open your practice?
I opened my practice the first year, 36, when I arrived here. You have to sign up. Most individuals, after passing the bar, take a refresher course. They don't just plunge in and take the bar. So I took that course, which carried over into 37, and so I took it the first opportunity in 37. I opened my office immediately after that, after I passed it the first time. And that was it.
And did you have very many clients that when you first started? How did you go about getting clients?
Clients, I knew everyone. And if I hadn't known them, by the time I got through in participating in those various dance battles of bands and standing at the door and helping admission people come in, and interestingly enough, one of the persons that helped me collect tickets at the door was Judge David Williams, who is presently a federal court judge. He helped me at the window collecting cash admissions, and I got to know everyone, youngsters. And when you put out posters for the dances and send out memos about the dances, you acquired name lists, and you made a very fine personal contact situation.
And so many of these people became your clients?
Yes, many of them, yeah.
What kinds of cases were you handling?
All kinds, and I got the all the railroad men were in dire difficulty. These cases were small, but they meant a lot to the individual who was suffering from attachments and another instrument called the power of attorney. They would, when they purchased goods on account, they would sign simultaneously at the request of the seller a power of attorney, which said that the power, the paper, authorized the employer to pay directly to the particular creditor company a sum of money out of the wages of the buyer. And this was a device that the vendors were using instead of attachments. And you couldn't attack a power of attorney by going to court. It was just a contractual thing. So we had to initiate with the aid of James Garcia, who was a very good brief man. We devised an instrument called a revocation of a power of attorney. And we start serving those on the Southern Pacific, Santa Fe, the Union Pacific. And we had all those employees and on our clients list. And we were able to get wages released right and left, so much so that they stopped using the power of attorney, these big companies.
So it was a way to exploit the railroad workers, what they were doing before?
Well, oh yes. As soon as they became aware of what was happening, they refused to sign. And the companies refused to use them anymore either, because they weren't being effective anymore. So we got all that railroad business, the waiters, and if we only got 5 or 6 hours a week, it was business, and we enjoyed a good business, yeah. And incidentally, I was able to develop girls who had typewriting skills and stenographic skills. I was using them as many as 5 and 6 of them at a time each day. And for just a small Central Avenue office, that was monumental. And these girls all became highly proficient, and so much so that the local L.A. Police Department became aware of their existence and would come to my office and solicit them for jobs and give them jobs. And about six or eight of my girls went to the LAPD, who wanted girls who could type and type well. And they figured that these girls in my office were really talented, and they were.
Yeah. Was there something that you started to become known for as an attorney? Did you have a specialty or to develop?
No, I took the cases as they came in, and things were so sorrowful for an attorney in those days that please remember, $5 was the filing fee in the Superior Court. $5, and it cost for an attorney to handle. Well, first of all, I could handle a divorce for $32, a whole divorce for $32, and make money.
Now what is it?
Hmm?
Now what is it?
Oh, they run up into an ordinary attorney with reasonable practice today could handle a divorce for $1,000 or $1,500. But the costs are so different. The filing fee, I think, is $80. $80 or $180 for a Superior Court. And the mechanics of a divorce case are so different today. They have interrogatories and they have discovery, and the opposition can serve upon a man, upon an attorney, maybe 200 different questions about every thing in the background of the individual, and then the attorney has to take time out to answer these and so forth. You didn't run into all that situation. I would handle divorces, as there would always be 30 and 40 divorces pending in my office, more than that. And on one day, through an accumulation, on one day, I filed as many as 75 or 80 divorces. And one of the local newspapers picked it up and set out the fact that it was kind of a record number from one office. But that's the way it was then. But don't remember, I was not making this great big money out of divorces. I guess some attorneys were. $35, and they could pay $5 or $10 down, and the girls would carry them on, and we would file them when they had paid in maybe $30 of the $35. That's the way you handle them. And there's no question, we kind of dominated the situation for a long time. And then it wasn't until about 1970 that I just quit handling divorces because of the extra work and the typographical work, and I didn't want to have the expense of secretaries, because once you start getting a number of secretaries, then here comes the government in with reference to withholding taxes and so forth. And as it were, in the earlier days, I had to have an accountant who was right there at my place. And you had to pay him a salary. And then with the other burdens coming on, well, it became prohibitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what other kinds of cases did you do?
Oh, I did lots of criminal work.
Defending or?
Defending, always defending. And lots of criminal work. Did lots of bankruptcies, and on the bankruptcies, didn't go through the process of going to court and charging the people the fees attended upon court appearances. Drew them up on pauper's affidavits and filed them that way and let the people process them themselves. So we had lots of bankruptcy matters pending all the time. And that type of practice, I became interested in sporting events, and I started going to the track. And going to the track, I got so I knew about horse racing and the prices the horses paid at the track, the type of bets that could be put down. I also, several clubs hired me to represent them with reference to gambling activities where they were gambling, like shooting dice. And I learned and had to read a lot behind dice and learning percentages and so forth. And it ended up I got a lot of bookmaking business, representing bookmakers. And if there were gambling clubs that were running illegal gambling, I would represent them because I did know about house percentages and banking percentage games. And I think I could classify myself as almost an authority on dice and bookmaking. And I could represent a defendant well in those things. And so it gave me a great diversity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there was a church in Los Angeles called Mount Zion Baptist Church. And it had a feud developing between the pastor and the congregation. And to show you how diversified my practice was, I represented the congregation against the minister. And the minister hired an attorney by the name of Morrow. His name was M-O-R-R-O-W. Morrow was a young attorney, but he's presently a Superior Court judge. So Morrow and I fought this case, this church religious case, and I had to know, and he had to know about rules of order and the church's rules. And we appeared before a Japanese judge by the name of Aiso. And this Japanese judge, on this particular day, it was an injunction, and it caused you to have to really study up on Robert's Rules of Order. So I performed, and Morrow performed, and then the judge called me back in chambers and said, the other day you were here on a dice game case and you seem to know a great deal about dice. He says, I'm kind of wondering about the the great diversity in your cases. And he laughed about it. He said, a religious case on one day and a dice game another. And by the way, this judge was, I saw where recently he was struck on the head and killed out in Hollywood, yeah, after he retired. But he was a very competent Japanese judge. Yeah.
But that kind of sums up the diversity of your cases in terms of what they were for.
So, yeah.
That you really had a great diversity in the kinds of cases you were taking.
Oh, yeah, you know, they're talking about a dice game, and that's kind of lowbrow, and then to be up there in the same breath, other religious, talking about religious law. But this is the diversity you got, you see.
Would there be certain cases that you just wouldn't take for one reason or another?
No. Unless it was some case that you knew just didn't have a chance of winning, and you could, in some instances, you opportunity to make money was given to you by clients who wanted a case fixed and all that sort of thing. But that was just out of the realm of possibility as far as I was concerned. And we wouldn't think of that. And to be very frank with you, I didn't run into any judges during all that time that showed the least inclination to be crooked. They were nearly, and this might have been because of the way I acted. Maybe I wasn't given the opportunity. I've been somewhat disillusioned here lately when I've talked to certain old timers who had informed me that there were certain people that were open to suggestion in those days. And it's hard for me to believe, but I've heard that some of them were, but they just didn't give me the opportunity. You know?
Oh, how do you classify what kind of lawyer you are? What would you call yourself? What kind of lawyer?
I would say general practitioner. General practitioner, right. Because here we were set up to know all about attachments on wages. We knew about the various codes to use. We had printed forms that we would go up, and we knew so much about getting employment wages released that even the girls in the office knew how to handle them without even consulting me. That's we knew all about the gambling side, the dice games. We knew about bankruptcies. We had forms for the bankruptcies. We divorces, orders show cause for payment of alimony for those sorts of things. It was just all the girls in the office were well informed, and they could interview clients, and of course subject to my approval. It was just they had a competence of knowing all those various subjects. Mm-hmm. And they all, when they leave me for various causes, all of them got good jobs, county jobs. And
What was the kind of the demographic makeup of your clients? Were most of your clients African American?
Was what?
Most of your clients black?
Yes, yeah. Oh, by the way, too, and I had a large waiting room. And every night when I finished during the day, it'd be three of us there, three attorneys there interviewing, not including Garcia, make four. And we would have a standing up crowd waiting every night. Say we start off with about 50 or 60 people. And those people, we would stay open until as late as 9, 10 o'clock at night, just interviewing. And that went on for years.
Yeah. Oh, so you had a like a joint practice with some other lawyers, an office with some other lawyers?
I paid salaries.
Uh-huh.
I paid them salaries. And
what did you call your business?
Just my name. It was, no, I would do this. It started off... Gordon Schaefer and Lang, then Gordon Raglan, and several other names, and then all through the years we'd add a man's name, like it became Gordon and Abels and somebody else, and the name any man that got work there could add his name to the window. Mm-hmm. I never kept it just my name alone. And if they could build up a practice of their own, they were able to do it. I allowed them to do it.
Mm-hmm. Were there many black lawyers in Los Angeles?
Yes. I figure there must have been. Most of them, though, were downtown in various places. About 26. Far cry from today, there's hundreds, but about 26. And don't forget, too, I was a young lawyer, and as a matter of fact, when I came out of law school, I was 29. And most of these old practitioners, they were very jealous of their own practice. They were located on Broadway, 2nd and Broadway. There was a Bryson building. And then it was a Wilson building, and there was Clarence A. Jones, a well-known old practitioner who I got along well with, Willis O. Tyler. Now, Jones was from Ohio State, graduated from Ohio State in 1912. And then there was Tyler, who graduated from Harvard. And then there was a man by the name of Wycliffe, who also graduated from Harvard. And a man named Cerutty, C-E-R-U-T-Y, who was also from big school. And these were very competent black lawyers. And but the only failure that you could attribute to them was they didn't get out with the masses. They were people, the client, whoever he was, and he could be some black person who was catching hell in a job, and he couldn't go downtown and find them very well. I was readily accessible at the corner of 41st and Central. And I built my own building. I built my own building in 6 years. And it was glass front, and had tile floors, and had fine, nice equipment, and a huge library. And it was a nice looking presentation. And then in evenings, I was skating on whether it was ethical or not, but I had no complaints. We had a revolving lighting system at the top. It was a green light, red light, so forth, going around a circle at the top of the building. And so it fit right in with Central Avenue at that time.
To attract business.
Right, because the crowd was going up and down Central Avenue in droves at night. And you had this great crowd coming from Beverly Hills and so forth to the Club Alabama. And any holiday, you could look out in front of your office and see as many as 300, 500, 600 people right out in front of your place all the time. It was a live thoroughfare. Entirely different today.
How have you seen it change?
Hmm?
How did you see it change there?
Well, the change came first with business places going west. First they would hit, some went to San Pedro Street from Central, some went over to Maine, then every now and then something to Figueroa, then they start moving to Vermont, and then Western, and the town was just spreading. Now as the town spread, nice buildings and things open up, and your building was getting older too. You follow me? So then the question came in whether to improve your building or to move. Well, that question was answered for me. I woke up one morning, my son called me and told me it was a huge blaze over the east side, and someone said it was a law office. And I couldn't believe it, but it was. It went up, and one of the attorneys there, drinking at night, had gone to sleep. And apparently left the office, and the office just was an inferno. And when that air hit it, it just went up in a jump.
Was it like he left a cigarette burning or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what was the cause of it.
What year was that?
That was, after the Black Panthers shooting situation, that they had the Black Panthers had a fight with the police, and the police used my office as fortification to shoot across the street to the blank bracket, the Panthers. So that was in the 60s. So that was the end of that office, and I was invited to share an office space on Martin Luther King around Dinker. and the man wouldn't accept any rent from me. So I was able to move in there, and I stayed there. I stayed there close to 10 years and never paid a penny rent. He wouldn't take it.
Where are you now?
I'm right here now. I don't maintain an office anymore.
Uh-huh. So that was the last office you had?
Uh-huh. Yes. By the way, that was only two I had all the time. Yeah.
What would you say, is there like a case or an event in your career that really stands out to you as being the most important or the most memorable?
Let's see. No, there were so many cases. For instance, Billie Holiday is just one of so many. There's so many people that there was a woman that Eva Jesse, tremendous choir leader. I had a case involving her. She was from a national figure, and I had a church case involving a minister who was allegedly stole money from his group, and they filed felony charges. I had so many cases.